The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about what happens when something that seems like a great thing at first goes to the dark side and takes you with it. I'm your host, Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm also your host, Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy. Sarah and I met, fell in love in a, quote, self-help organization that turned out to be a mega cult called Nexium. Heard of it? We got out of there together, and on our way out, we helped shut it down. Our journey as Nexium whistleblowers was captured in detail on a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, and also on the front page of a newspaper.
New York Times, babe.
Right.
Have you heard of it? Each week on A Little Bit Culty, we talk with other former cult members and whistleblowers, plus experts in things like cultic abuse and coercive control.
We also turn the mic over to advocates and clinicians with wisdom to share on recovering from everything from MLMs and toxic religion to bad romances with raging narcissists.
There's always something to learn about the cultiverse. Be sure to subscribe to A Little Bit Culty so you don't miss an episode. Find us on Instagram and at alittlebitculty.com.
Welcome back, everyone. Sarah?
Yes, Nippy.
Another doc, another cult.
Another day in the life of A Little Bit Culty. And you know, I look forward to this summer when we take a little break from the cult content. I've got some other shows I need to watch. Yep. I have nothing to do with cults. Even when we tried to watch Yellowstone and take a little break, remember that we're branding the ranchers?
Yeah, it's just not a good one to watch before you go to bed.
Noted trigger alert there for Yellowstone fans.
But I did just watch a doc on Henry Ford. That was pretty amazing.
That was a nice break for you. I'm glad you had that.
It was.
I love that journey for you.
Felt knowledgeable.
And speaking of docs, we still don't know when season two of The Vow is coming. I promise you guys will be like the second to know after we call my mom, give her the heads up, and then we'll post it on Instagram. And honestly, I will let you know like within minutes of
we're
me
not
finding
in it, so don't get too excited.
We're in it a little bit is all we know, but there should be much more interesting things than our journeys, which are benign really compared to what other people went through. Some other housekeeping things. Again, thank everybody who entered the t-shirt contest.
I love how this is housekeeping and our house is a mess right now.
Such a disaster.
I'm just looking around.
Crazy. Moving is not fun.
No.
But Nippy will be in the U.S. and we'll send the t-shirts from there next week. Congrats to all those who won. And please do continue to send stories of you listening to A Little Bit Culty. We love seeing the driving of the tractors, the making of the donuts, the cooking, pushing your kids in the baby carriage. The best one, though, was somebody who shared that she listened to A Little Bit Culty whilst in labor, and that really helped her get through it. Can you believe that? I'm like so honored to be a part of someone's birthing journey.
That's intense.
Yeah, it's intense. Also, we should let you know we are going to take a little break for the summer. There may or may not be some bonus episodes dropping. Stay tuned. But we will be back in full force for season five, starting with some amazing guests, including very fascinating conversation about toxic spirituality, how to recover, and how to not throw out the baby with the bathwater with Eckhart Tolle. So that was great. Didn't you enjoy that?
Yeah, that was. This was our first live.
Oh, yeah.
Too.
We got to do it with him in person.
Like in person.
In a room with Eckhart. I worked really hard to stay present in the now. I was so tired after.
Well, also the room was so quiet because of the soundproof room. And it just felt like a calming presence.
He's so calming.
Oh, no, he really is.
And then the other one that we're super excited about, two more I'll share with you to get you excited also, is we have a two-parter for sure. There's 2 hours worth of an incredible conversation with one of my personal heroes, Evan Rachel Wood, who we've been supporting and following since she publicly named her abuser over a year ago. And the other little tease we'll share with you is we have a fascinating interview with Dr. Romani, who is a narcissist expert. And I think you all are going to love that combo.
She's great. And if you have a chance, look her up before and just, I mean, her TED Talk's only like 10 minutes and it's so good. She just drops knowledge for like, what is it, 5, 10 minutes, right, Sarah? And she goes off.
Yeah.
It's like a guitar solo. It's so good.
So stay tuned for season five, but for the finale, something that we felt was important because there's a doc out right now. And just a heads up, this episode does get into very gritty territory. There will be discussions of alleged sexual assault and child abuse. Listener discretion is advised.
To paraphrase a headline from a 2020 Gizmodo investigation piece by Jed Olbaum, our guest today, quote, helped build a shady guru's YouTube army, and now she's his fiercest critic. But who will believe her? End quote.
Well, we do. We fucking believe her. At just 24 years old, Sarah Landry found herself hooked by the teachings of self-proclaimed Hindu guru Nityananda. He talks about animal rights and the need to go beyond the social conveyor belt of school, work, marriage, family, and death. And his philosophies on creating conscious communities, they all drew her in, like flies to honey. Moldy, toxic honey.
At Nityananda's instruction to recruit more people in, Sarah started a YouTube channel in 2011 and built up a following of over 50,000 subscribers, many of whom became new devotees and paid copious amounts of money to attend his programs.
But in 2018, Sarah found out that although the organization claims to be ahimsa, nonviolent, it was hiding a sordid stew of allegations: rape, violence against children, and criminal fraud.
Scared for her life, she stayed silent until 2019, when at last she realized she couldn't keep that to herself anymore and blew the whistle through Facebook posts and YouTube videos.
Since then, she's been retaliated against with outlandish claims that she too is a rapist or a Vatican-paid double agent. The whistleblower fallout has been real.
She joins us today to talk about her journey and why she's not going to stop working to deplatform culty characters like Nityananda, who's currently reported to be on the lam and hiding out in India, and others like him. So this is something I just want people to put into context as well before we get into this. This guy who's, quote, on the lam, according to India Times, has his own island now called Kalisa. It's his own country, right? This is a guy who's supposedly on the lam from the FBI and Interpol. Interpol issued something that's called a blue corner notice that allows Interpol to locate, identify, and gather information on this guy, right? So supposedly he's dodging that, has a country, has a website selling his videos and paraphernalia and merch, and his country has its own passport and flag, which admits you to the country, 11 dimension, and 14 locus. And Interpol and FBI can't find this guy. So you're expecting us to believe this guy is accused of rape and all these things, has his own country and website? So enjoy this one, because this one's absurd in a lot of ways.
Without further ado, here's our guest, Sarah Landry. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Hey, Sarahs.
Hi.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This episode is Nippy and the Sarahs. We may refer to ourselves as Sarah E., host of A Little Bit Culty, Sarah L., the guest on A Little Bit Culty today.
You're going to figure that one out, I think.
Sarah, where are you calling from? Where are you these days?
I'm in southern Alberta, back in my hometown, a bit south of Calgary, and longtime listener, first-time caller. So it's really great to be on the air with you.
It's so wonderful to finally be doing this. I know we've been social media friends for a long time, and I really commend all the work that you've done to expose the truth about your former guru.
And your Twitter posts have been informative too. I'm rarely on Twitter, but your feed comes across mine a lot.
Yeah, I think you both have inspired me a lot to be outspoken and just not bother about whatever counterattacks come from the cult, but just keep telling the truth because it does reach people.
It does.
The irony is not lost on me. Yeah, we'll bring our listeners up to speed. And obviously we'll have mentioned the doc, the Vice doc, which we found educational, but like really hard to follow in terms of, I know you didn't make it, so I'm not criticizing you. It's just there's so much.
There's a lot of variables to overcome in watching it. Timeline ones is hard one for me when they go back and forth. But I mean, I get it.
The timeline is hard, but mostly I just found, like, compared to some of the other cult exposés that have been out there, is that like a lot of what I think what's great, especially with the vow, is how they really show what was good about it. You know, like what the draw was. And I felt like I got tidbits of that from you and also from Jordan.
Yeah, they threw us right into the trauma right away.
Yeah, versus like what was good before the bad shit started happening. So maybe you could take us back to that.
Did they ask you about that, the filmmakers?
Not really, no. I think the reason is it was made by Vice India, not by Vice Global, and specifically aimed at an Indian audience. So for the majority of people in India, he's been a household name for like the past nearly 20 years.
Got it.
If it had been made for a Western audience, it probably would have gone more into what were the draws, what was good about it.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Tell us about where you were at when you found him, what was going on in your life, and what did you think you were signing up for?
Okay. Well, it's funny. I don't know if you remember, Sarah, but we discussed this like 2.5 years ago once. And I remember you told me if you had caught me first, you would have recruited me into Nexium. And I kind
Absolutely.
Of Absolutely. And I told you, well, if I had found you first, I would have brought you to Nityananda. So
Here we go.
Battle of the bad gurus.
Yeah. Battle of the gurus.
Battle of the Sarah recruiters.
All right. Yeah. So at the time, I had lived in Vancouver to attend art school at Emily Carr. And I got a little disillusioned by the art scene because they were really pushing shock value, disturbing subject matter, which isn't what I was into. You know, I wanted to make beautiful things. And I'm not sure how familiar you were with Granville Island, but it's like an artist haven.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
We live near it.
20-minute walk from us.
Yeah. Oh, it's my favorite. I probably walked past your place to get to school because I'd walk from my apartment on Heather Street down the seawall.
Yeah.
Yeah. So by going to school on Granville Island, I found the Crystal Ark and Dragon Space and all these really mystical little shops.
I loved those places.
I used to work at Dragon Space. It's my favorite place I ever worked.
I spent so much money there in the 90s. So many crystals and tarot cards. And I'm surprised we never met. We may have met, actually.
We may have met. I may have sold something to you and we just didn't know because we weren't in the cult yet.
I feel like this is the beginning of a movie. We need to write something based on this. The Sarahs and their different cults intersecting at Dragon Space.
Actually, that would be so cool, right? Because we both got into these big cults and then we both became whistleblowers.
I love it. I have goosebumps.
Yeah.
Granville Island, the origin of whistleblowers.
Yes, I like it.
If you want a whistleblower, you just go visit Granville Island.
Go visit Granville Island. Dragon Space would love this if it's included. Go buy something from Dragon Space.
So you were working there. You were disillusioned with art school.
Yeah. And so I felt like the beauty I was searching was more available in the spiritual world than the fine art community. And so I started going to, you know, spiritual talks at Banyan Books and things at the Buddhist Center. There was a Rinpoche who visited and he just seemed so fascinating. And one day I was on my way home from work and I just felt compelled to get off the bus and to go into a center on Broadway that had a sign that said free meditation. And it looked fairly innocuous. It looked like just the front. It was called Life Bliss Foundation. I got there. It seemed like synchronous, perfect timing because as soon as I stepped up to the door, a lady opened it and said, "We're starting the meditation in 5 minutes. I was coming to lock the door, but you're the last one to arrive. Come on in." That made me feel like it was predestined or something. Mm-hmm. And the meditation was wonderful. We sat in a big room. They were burning incense. There was really cool sitar music playing in the background. There was a fairly large crowd, mostly Indian people, but a few Western people. And the meditation was like nothing I'd ever done before. And I think it would have been a red flag if I had known anything about Rajneesh and Osho, because it was basically a hijacked version of his dynamic meditation. Mm. So it started with chaotic breathing, then intense humming, and putting the attention in each of the 7 chakras, followed by this really beautiful Sanskrit chant that they told us to just sit in the space of listening. And this gives a connection to the guru who brought down this technology, who made this meditation available.
Did they use the word technology?
They use the word technology, yes. A lot. Wow.
Red flag.
A lot.
Red flag.
Red flag.
Yeah.
Technology's getting a bad rap.
Right? Yeah. I remember they would tell us that Nityananda's teachings are a technology stack for enlightenment. So very red flaggy. But at the time, I had no idea. I just thought this feels good. I felt really energized after the meditation. I've been a strict vegan since the age of 13. So it was really cool for me that all the food they served us was vegan. And I liked that. Mm. They told us that, you know, this is a tradition for those who want to live a life of ahimsa, of nonviolence and compassion. And there were things that struck me as weird when I was first there that I pushed past my initial hesitation because I wanted to understand it. So the weird thing is everyone was dressed in white head to toe. And I thought that was a little weird. It was a little bit culty. And I didn't know that. So they told us that in the yoga sampradaya, the color white absorbs more energy and dark colors repel energy. And I was wearing a black shirt and they said you're closed because you're wearing black. So if you wear white, you let in all of this divinity. If you wear black, it's like you're closing yourself off. So I feel like even from day one, I started changing my wardrobe choices. And I always wear my hair down in interviews now because they told us it curses people if they see the ends of your hair as a woman. And so always tie your hair up in a bun or wear it in a braid. Because if you wear your hair loose, whoever looks at you will have a bad day.
Right.
So there were really weird little cultural things that I accepted them because I thought, well, this is just Hinduism. And I didn't know much about Hinduism other than that I thought the deities were beautiful and I liked the music. But yeah, I think where I was at in that time of life was seeking.
You were early 20s, right?
Yeah, I was 24.
You know, I heard you say something, one of the reasons that you let it go is because you wanted to understand it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good kind of hook because ultimately, I think what we find out is there's nothing really to understand.
Exactly.
But you go into it, quote, open, wanting to understand, and there's nothing really there of substance to understand, which has you thinking that it's you.
Exactly. You nailed it. Like they would actually say if anybody had a question, for example, in the meditation halls, men had to sit on one side, women had to sit on the other side. And married couples would sometimes say, hey, like we came to this program together. Why can't we sit next to each other? And
they separate you.
They'd separate us. If you attend a program with a best friend or a parent, they will give you a different roommate, not the person you signed up with, because they didn't want you to talk to each other and vent your doubts or talk about, hey, right. You know what? I didn't really feel anything in that energy, Darshan, did you? They would put newcomers with long timers.
We did that at lunches too, remember now?
Yeah, we would do that at lunch. We would go talk to people.
We spread out, we'd like divide and conquer. No, we were specifically like all the coaches go and like make sure that the new students weren't like huddling, being like, this is a bit weird, right?
We did that.
So I guess my question, Sarah, is did they overtly say, hey, let's separate them for these reasons? Was that an open policy? Was like,
yeah,
it was?
They wouldn't tell that to you if you were signing up to attend a program.
But the staff would know that.
Yeah. And nobody was paid. It was all volunteers. So all the volunteers knew that. All the, they called them Adinavasis, the people who live in his Adinam, which is like a fancy word for ashram with a temple in it. So yeah, they would literally tell us if a family stays together as a family, if one of the kids has a temper tantrum and wants to leave, we lose the whole family. But if you separate them and the kid throws a tantrum and wants to leave, the volunteer who's with that kid can calm the kid down and it won't affect the parents' connection to, they would call him Swamiji. My mom coined the phrase Scammiji for him instead. So now I call him that.
I like that.
They would overtly separate people on purpose so that whoever had a doubt could be talked into believing it.
Also, it creates division in the family because if one person's deeper in and the other's like, hold on a second, that's a problem.
Yeah, I want to know a little bit more about how you got from, you know, just taking the classes to becoming a full devotee. What was the timeline for that? And, or, you know, if you tell us the whole thing, but like, what were the sort of major steps in your commitment?
Yeah, it was very, very sudden for me. It was almost instantaneous because the day that I went in for a free program was a Wednesday. And the following Wednesday, Nityananda was physically in Vancouver to do a program in person for one day. And so I didn't have much time to think about whether or not I want to meet him or see him in person. It was like now or never.
Scarcity.
Yeah. It could have been his last world tour, which it was, because he couldn't travel after the rape case got filed. So yeah, from one Wednesday to the next Wednesday, I started watching all of his videos on YouTube. He had a huge library of discourses that he had given. And at first, there was a bit of an accent barrier. I had trouble understanding what he was saying. But after watching maybe three or four videos, I could understand him really fluently. And in those days, like back in 2009, everything he'd recorded up till then was very humble and sounded very sincere. he wasn't preaching anything extreme, like you have to become Hindu to follow him. What he said that really grabbed me at first was that there are multiple paths that lead to enlightenment, and each path is valid, each path is equal. Each religion and each teacher is like a garden. And the job of the seeker is to visit each garden, pick the flowers that you love most, and with that, you string the garland of your enlightenment.
Oh, I love that.
It was so beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he plagiarized somebody. I just don't know who yet. Yeah. I loved it so much. And I teared up and thought, well, this is what I've been looking for, because I didn't like the traditions that boast exclusivity. Like, it's this or nothing, all or nothing. And so he felt safe at first because of that. And when I went to his one-day program, which was called Kalpataru, I was a little shocked by how many people were there. There were about 500 or 600 people in a big, it seemed like a wedding venue, kind of a hall in Surrey. And they had security guards guarding the stage because women were trying to throw themselves at him. Like, people were literally standing up and trying to get onto the stage. So he had like a full security force hired. And I wasn't expecting that. And I remember the moment he entered the hall, I felt an energy, which may have been placebo effect. It could have been my imagination, but I believed I felt something. And so the confirmation bias kicked in, and I thought, well, he must be radiating something powerful, because if he wasn't, why am I feeling this way? And so it was pretty quick that I became what they would call a devotee, like a follower who believes in him. And then, like, flash forward a couple of years after I had attended a few more of the programs and gone to India, I think the day I became a disciple, which is devotee, like you believe in him and you worship him. Disciple, it's like you do what he tells you to do. So it's a more serious commitment. That happened for me when he went for a live video discourse. And at the beginning of it, either he cried or he pretended to cry, but he was like shaking and wiping his eyes and saying, there's nobody here to help me with my mission. People come to me, they take my energy, they take my teachings, they go back to the world, they benefit, but there's nobody here to help me enlighten humanity. And he made it sound like he was all alone in this. And he started denouncing a lot of his inner circle people. Like, all of the sannyasis who are sitting at my feet here, they're just here to escape the world and to eat the free food and to have the free accommodation, but there's nobody here taking responsibility. And they closed the curtain and ended the satsang, which is what his discourses were called, really abruptly. And that whole night I couldn't sleep. I was thinking, like, how much do the people around him suck if he's crying over the fact that nobody's helping with his mission? I felt sorry for him. So the next day, he gives a really short discourse and said, if you felt pained by the fact that I have no one helping in my mission, then that means you are being called to take it up as your mission. And the way you can do that is to bring 10 people to the next inner awakening. And of course, that's a 21-day program. That's like their brainwashing mechanism, is this inner awakening program. And it cost at that point $10,000. Participant. So he basically made all of us into overzealous salespeople, feeling like we're charged with a divine mission to recruit people to his paid program. And I knew my family wouldn't be interested in going. I knew none of my friends could afford it. We were all, you know, ex-art school students paying off our student loans, working retail jobs. So I thought, the only way I can become his disciple and bring 10 people to inner awakening is through YouTube. So I started making YouTube videos talking about what I had experienced in India, kind of reading pages out of his books at random and saying, like, look at this, you can open to any random page and the message will be something exactly pertaining to your situation, which really caught a lot of people. And there were more than 10 who went to the next inner awakening from my YouTube videos. And so I started to get really encouraged by his organization to make more videos and to keep doing what I was doing. And for me, that was kind of fun because I could still live in Vancouver and do my thing and enjoy my life. And on the side, just make a video once a week. So it didn't feel like he had overtaken my entire life until 2015 in May, it was the year my mom retired. So she said, okay, finally, I've got time. I'm going to come with you to one of these inner awakenings. And from the day that we got there, I was exceptionally love bombed by the guru and by everyone around him. He called me to sit at the very center of the floor where he had his throne set up, the closest person to him.
How did that feel?
It felt really good at that time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, I'd always been just an anonymous person in the crowd before that. I didn't know he knew me by name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So for 5 years, you were just a devotee and then more of a disciple once you started doing social media for him. But you weren't having personal interactions with him.
No, none at all. I had no personal interaction. The only time I would have an interaction with him was during what they call darshan, where people line up on either sides of the stage and one by one we go and he'd like touch our third eye or put his hand on our head. So my only interactions were in the public space.
Let me clear this up. So based on your YouTube videos, you were driving people, you were driving business to him.
Yes.
Yeah. So he knows who you are. Yeah.
Yeah. Now he knows who you are. Before we get to like this stage of it, can you just like paint for our audience and for us too, like a little bit of, or maybe this wasn't the case yet because you were still in Vancouver, but like what's the day-to-day use of these tools? Like what's your life look? You didn't live at the ashram at this point. So you were between 2010 to 2015, you weren't at the ashram, but like what's your life like in regards to how this works? Like are you showing up once a week? Do you do it all day long? Like what's it like?
Yeah, so the way it would work for those of us outside of the audinam, we could work our jobs as usual or interact with friends and family as usual. But every single day at 7 p.m. Vancouver time, which was 7 a.m. in India, he would do a 1 hour live discourse that was mandatory for all devotees. And so 7 days a week, every single day, no matter what I was doing in my life, I knew I had to log in to his page at exactly 7 o'clock and be there for an hour to watch his discourse. So it didn't leave much room for a social life. You can't really go out for dinner with people if you have to be home from 7 till 8 every day. And we did that religiously. Nobody missed his so-called satsang. And we would go to volunteer at the temple, which in Vancouver, we didn't really have a temple. We had a center, a meditation center. But that could be anything from arranging flowers next to the screen where they projected his discourse to welcoming in newcomers or distributing materials, like helping with the printing for his pamphlets and brochures. And in that sense, even just being an outside devotee, there was still a level of commitment involved. We all felt like his teachings were working for us because people would get into a really happy state when the curtain would open and in this live video, he would start talking. There was something really charismatic about his way of speaking. He had a way of talking about generalities that felt specific to you. So he could be talking about how the world is looking to see what it can get from you, but your enlightenment is what you can give to yourself and share with others and radiate it to raise the frequency of the world. It was very, very general, but we would each apply it to ourselves in a way that felt specific.
Mm-hmm.
So after his discourses, like you'd hear people in the center saying, wow, like earlier today, I was talking to a friend about why this feels like that. And he said it. He said it. It's like people would think that he was telepathically hearing their thoughts. Right. And then saying it in the discourses.
Was there a particular, and I know it's hard to go back to like when things were good and golden and, you know, shiny, but like if there, you were to kind of summarize the pillars of the teachings, like if I had met you and you tried to recruit me, I'm like, well, what's it all about? Like, what's the goal of the company and what are the beliefs? How would you have summarized that?
I would have said it's an open framework of Sanatana Dharma, where we can integrate the ancient teachings and the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Agamas, but apply them to modern day life. And what he would say is that in the ancient times when the scriptures were first brought down by the ancient rishis and munis and enlightened beings, they were talking to a society in a Satyuga, which was like a golden era where everyone had a deeper connection to existence than people do today. And that in the time since those scriptures were revealed, humanity has fallen down into the Kali Yuga, which is like an age of darkness. And so people have lost their connection. And we can read the scriptures, but we don't understand how they apply to us. And he was there to help his followers get what he called a yogic body and a Vedic mind. So your body will become strengthened through the yoga and the sattvic diet, and your mind will be strengthened through the absorption of those scriptures. And we believed it. I fell for it. I really believed that that's what he was giving us.
Do you use any of those tools, technology, beliefs? Like, is any of that still part of your life, or did you throw it all out?
Not really, no. I threw it all out. I realized that we can read a Vedic scripture and benefit from it. We don't need a middleman. You don't need some greedy guy who either wants to rape you or steal your money to be the intermediary between you and some ancient truth.
Well put.
I didn't throw out Sanatana Dharma. Like, I've always loved Hinduism. From the time I was a kid and I had a vision of goddess Kali, that was kind of the beginning of my fascination with Hinduism. So I've kept that, but I've thrown away the way he would misappropriate or translate the scriptures to suit his agenda.
The con man.
The con man.
Take out the con man.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. So when do you go from devotee living in Vancouver to moving into the ashram?
During that May program where he pulled me to sit close to him and really love bombed me, there was a night when one of the senior swamis on his personal team, so like the really inner circle group, pulled me aside at the end of the day's program and said, why don't you sit with me? Let's have some coffee. Let's talk. That felt very special. That guy's name was Nyanaswarupa Swami. And he's one of the people who died mysteriously after deciding to escape the cult. Mm. I really still want to know what happened to him, which is why I mentioned him by name. But I felt like it was a very special thing because this is one of the people who stays with Nityananda physically. Like, he lives in his room, takes care of him, feeds him, washes up after him. So it felt really cool that he wanted to spend time with me because he was usually not around program participants. And he told me, you know, Swamiji is so excited that you're here. He was telling everyone how lucky we are to have you as a part of this community. What do you do in Canada? And so I told him, like, I make jewelry and I sell it on Etsy and I'm really into crystals and I do tarot readings. I love that kind of mystical stuff. And he asked me, do you think that you can enlighten humanity through that work? And I said, no, I feel like I can share my joy for jewelry. I might be able to, you know, inspire one or two people, but I don't think I could enlighten humanity doing this. So he said, then why don't you become an Adinivasi? Why don't you take the vow of Brahmacharyam and join the monastic order? And it's not that I had never wanted to do that. I had actually applied for that in 2010 when I attended my first program, but the scandal happened. And so all the applications were denied and we were told they couldn't take anybody at that point in time.
Backtrack for a second. What was the scandal in 2010 and how was it shared with you? Like, what were you told was happening?
So in early February of 2010, the entire country of India went crazy over a sex tape that got leaked to the media of Nityananda getting like a blowjob from an actress named Ranjita. And we were all told that it's a morphed video, that anti-Hindu elements had planted cameras in his bedroom and then using some kind of CGI made it look like he was having an affair with her, but it wasn't true. And that, you know, Catholic missionaries were behind it and they're doing an investigation to find out who had morphed this video. They told us that the ex-disciples who were giving interviews with the media saying, no, this is real, we took the videos, they told us that those ex-disciples had attempted to extort money from them by saying, you know, if you don't give us money, we're going to create a fake video and release it to the media. So Nityananda spun it in a way that made him sound like a victim.
Of course.
It sounds familiar.
Yeah.
For those of our listeners who haven't yet watched the Vice documentary, My Daughter's Joined a Cult, the sex tape, I mean, they didn't obviously
show. It looks like a pillow fight.
It looked like a cuddle tape.
It looks like
tape.
WrestleMania.
Yeah, it looks like, because I guess they're obviously not going to show the blowjob on TV or in the documentary, but it wasn't like, oh, sex tape. It was like, oh, are they in the spoon? Like, literally. So it's good to know what it actually was. So that was released in India on TV and everyone went nuts for it. And then it was denied, but nothing happened.
He did get arrested. So he fled his ashram, I think a day or two before the tape was released, because they had heard of an advance warning. Like, one of his rape victims, a lady named Aarti Rao, and one of his ex-inner circle people, who was his personal driver, a guy named Lenin Karupan, they had let somebody else in the organization know that they were going to take this measure if he didn't just own up to the public about the fact that he had sexually abused people. And what they really wanted was for him to come clean. Like, you know what? You've gotten away with this charade for long enough. You've conned people into thinking that you're a celibate sannyasi. We know you're not. You've hurt people. They wanted like an apology. I remember somewhere in that docuseries, Aarti said that the reason she felt the need to release that video to the public was that when Nityananda made it really clear that he is never going to take responsibility for his crimes, she felt nobody would believe her that he's a rapist unless they could see him engaged in a sexual act with somebody.
Even that's not enough.
It wasn't for a lot of us, because we thought, hey, it's a morphed video. Why should I believe an anti-Hindu abuser? So it's really disturbing that a lot of us didn't believe in that video. I personally didn't even watch it because I didn't want to see something made to attack my guru.
Of course.
Everything you're saying is consistent with the nature of people that are under some sort of coercive control. I mean, we're talking about this last night, Sarah. One of the things about coercive control it has going for it is a lot of people think it's bullshit. And that's why telling your story is so important. But everything you're saying, right, Sarah?
Yeah, including like we didn't read a lot of the media against Keith because there was this whole teaching about like you had a thought object of somebody, like what you think about somebody. Like I have a thought object of you, Sarah, of our brief interactions and what you've done in the media. I don't know you that well, but I have a thought of you, and it's sort of like an object in my head. And when you hear something negative about somebody, your thought object changes, right? So even if it's not true, like if I hear that you're actually an avid bowler, you know, and you're a bowling fiend or whatever, I'm just trying to think of something that's not going to hurt my thought object of you. Like, even if you're like, just kidding, I'm not into bowling, in my head, I now have bowling linked with you. So they taught us, if you read anything negative about somebody or hear something negative, you'll never be able to cleanse the thought object of that person. So we were encouraged to never read the media because it's all the smear campaign.
Yeah.
That's dangerous because there's truth to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is truth to that. But there's the consistency of everyone being encouraged to ignore what's anything negative that's shared. And I think that's just such a red flag for people. If people are in something, anything, and media comes out and they're encouraged to not look at it, that should be something to look at.
Exactly. Nitti would do the same thing to all of us, where he told us, if we watch that morphed video, even though it's not real, we will see him as an ordinary man with ordinary lust, and that would interfere with his ability to transmit the cosmic consciousness to us. And so it was this big fear in all of us that if we even accidentally see that video while walking down the street in Mumbai or something, and we look into a shop and it's on their TV, that would be detrimental to our guru-disciple relationship. So we not only didn't watch the video, but we actively avoided exposing ourselves to any Indian media. And it also became really difficult for us because 90% of the news was not in English. It was in Kannada, which is the local language where he had his adinam, or Tamil, which is the local language from his birth state, or Hindi or Gujarati, but there was very little English coverage of his scandal. So even the few friends I had who tried to figure out what's the other side saying, we couldn't. There was a language barrier.
There's a word that you've used a number of times, Arilam. Is that the same thing as an ashram or is that different?
It is. Adinam is more of a South Indian concept that refers to a Shaivite monastery temple complex. So when there's an ashram and a temple combined in one. So it's like a little self-sufficient spiritual community.
It's like a kibbutz in Israel, but with a temple and a guru.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there has to be a living guru there.
Right. Sidebar. Where did Eat, Pray, Love fall in?
She never said.
It's a total tangent, but I'm just like, at the time of Eat, Pray, Love, all kinds of women, but especially white middle-aged women from all over North America go to India to like find themselves and get caught up in shit like this. I'm just wondering.
Eat, Pray, Love was published the year I found Nitti.
Oh.
And when I told my family that I'm back then, they didn't call it an Adinam yet. They called it an ashram. So when I told them this December, instead of coming home for Christmas, I'm going to India to attend a program at this ashram. My mom at first was like, wait, what? Like, you have to come home for Christmas. Mm-hmm. But one of my aunties who had read Eat, Pray, Love calmed her down and said, no, this is a really cool thing. You should read this book. You'll understand the journey your daughter is on. And so that book was kind of like an anesthetic.
Wow.
I knew I brought it up for a reason. It wasn't a total
EPL.
EPL,
man. Wreaking havoc on the world through EPL.
Maybe we'll have Elizabeth Gilbert on one day and talk to her about her effects in the world as an ashram supporter.
Yes. Well, and Nityananda, he told people that she was not a true spiritual seeker because a true spiritual seeker would have done Eat, Love, Pray. This was one of his discourses. And he said, eating is like the base human instinct, survival need. Mm-hmm. Praying is the most divine human instinct where you connect with the cosmos. And then love should come between those two because a baby is born and wants to eat, matures a little, wants to fall in love, and then matures even more and wants to connect with God. So he told all of us, don't read Eat, Pray, Love because she's mixed up the order.
Of course. We'll make sure to pass that on to her if she comes on our podcast.
Yeah, she got it. Yeah. Got it backwards.
Hey, A Little Bit Culty listeners. Bless your little bitty hearts for helping support this podcast. You asked us to put a link up where you could make a one-time or monthly contributions to help us cover the costs of taking this podcast from our living room to your earbuds. And so we did. And wow, you weren't kidding around when you said you wanted to help this podcast keep on cranking out episodes. You stepped up. Thank you. In fact, in a relatively short time, 70 of you have already chipped in. And together, the whole beautiful lot of you have covered the cost of making almost 5 full A Little Bit Culty episodes. That's pretty freaking good. You are amazing. Did you know that? And yes, we're talking to you, Veronica Wells, Annie Blake, Thomas Wicks, and John Breen, and you, Kenny Bernstein, and Kristen O'Rourke. You rule, Sarah Priestley and Roger Seidman, and you are rad. Andrea Padillas, Helena Durst, Sally Lotz, Joel Blair, and Jolene Bishop. That's just a few of you who are helping to make this podcast happen. Want to make a contribution? Just go to alittlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio. Every little bit helps keep A Little Bit Culty trucking along. Thanks again. We adore you. Back to the timeline. Anything else you want to share about how good it was? Like when things were, like when I heard Jordan in the doc explaining the mission and like you just thought it was the best thing ever. And like, can you paint the vibes, paint the picture for us about what that was like?
Yeah, the things that were good about it that made me feel like I was really meant to be a part of this were that I really loved everything about India. I love the architecture of the ancient temples, the way the deities look, the clothing. Like you walk down any Indian street and half the women you see are wearing bright, vibrant saris covered in rhinestones and glitter. Like there was just something magical about the look, the aesthetic of India. So I think I really fell for the visual glamour that was put on in India. I love the music. I love the sitar sounds. It's just so different from what we hear on the radio here. Mm. I started to believe that Nityananda was the one who was going to bring all the best things of India and make them available to those of us in the West.
Right.
So the way Jordan described how he felt like he found his tribe, I felt that too. Because everyone who entered that auditorium, whether they were Indian or Western, we all shared this common mission, which was to enlighten the world. And that's a red flag. I've heard other guests of yours say this, like if your guru says that they are the only one who can enlighten the entire planet, that's a red flag. So Nityananda, like he radically shifted his deliverable. Like in the early days, he said, there are many paths, each one is valid. That shifted after the scandal. I feel like if he was bad before that scandal, he became full sinister after the scandal. It's like he was overcompensating.
Well, that's the George Orwell quote about tyrants. They use fraud and force. And once the fraud is exposed, they go full on with force.
That's exactly it.
And they double down. The thing that's most staggering about all of them is that even when they're caught, they double down. It's pretty amazing.
And also victimize themselves.
Yes.
All of these spiritual structures have like some sort of construct about how being a victim isn't good and that there are no victims and you have choice and you have free will. But the guru, when accused of anything, is a victim and always of a conspiracy.
Exactly.
It's always a conspiracy against him of people who want to take him down.
And woe is me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm bringing this to the world and this is the slings and arrows that I endure and I expected it.
Oh, so you've listened to his discourses.
Oh, no, that was Keith.
Well, that's also Nityananda.
Yeah.
This is the manuscript for these things.
Yeah. Yeah. He literally told us, like, Sarah, when you were saying nobody is a victim, there was a whole special discourse that he gave about victim mentality. And he said, victim mentality is the lowest negative emotion you can fall into that will be like a black hole sucking other people down into your misery. And that in reality, you can never be violated because anything which you perceive as violating you is you violating that by your projection that it's violating you.
Say that again.
That's word salad.
Say it one more time.
You can never be violated. Anything which you perceive as violating you, you are violating that through your projection, which is saying that it has violated you.
So it's gaslighting yourself. So it's accusing you of doing the behavior that you're accusing someone of doing, which is abusive. So the abuser, the victim is the abuser. It's a similar thing that we had.
Yeah.
He'd give examples, like part of the public shaming, he had this thing he called the completion process.
What? It's called the completion process?
He accused Teal Swan of plagiarizing him. So that was another thing that happened.
Oh,
I was going to say.
Guru-offs. I want to see these gurus go at it. Oh, let's pull them on a room.
Total tangent side note. I had a pitch for a reality show where I think they should get all of these people and put them on an island like Survivor.
Oh my God.
And each one has to brainwash each other and like the last guru standing wins.
I love it.
It would be a 30-year show. Someone would have to die before they admit wrongdoing.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Bento Box, Teal Swan, Nityananda, Keith Raniere, Tony Robbins.
I would bet on Tony Robbins.
Yeah, he'd win.
That guy's an endurance athlete. He just, he's up all day and he's like, it's your mother. It's your mother. And you're like, fine. It's my mom.
He's like drinking charcoal water and like in the sauna. And he's like,
you got nothing on me.
Yeah.
I could do this all day long.
Excuse me. I'm in a cold pool real quick.
We love cold pools, just so you know.
Oh,
we're not making fun of the cold pool, but.
Oh, I'm a huge fan of the cold pool.
So that's my tangent. I would love to make that show happen. And I did a podcast with a Canadian comedian guy and I brought that up. And he said he actually has an agent who works with Adult Swim Channel. So he's like, we could make it as a cartoon. So that would be like a dream for me.
Oh my God. Amazing.
Right?
Sarah, you can do some of the voiceovers for it.
I would actually really like to play Teal Swan. And by the way, her followers, I've never had a more aggressive group of people come after us just to explain how wrong we are and how she's not a cult and stuff and are encouraging us to interview her. And I think I want to. I actually really want to have her on. Like if I could have anybody on, it would be Teal. So just putting it
out
there.
That would be the one episode I don't listen to.
I got to tell you, Sarah, you might be on your own on that one.
Well, listen,
you might be on your own on that.
If it goes really bad, we just don't use it. It's not like it's live. I would never do a live event.
What happens when she does her Jennifer Connelly death stare to you?
I go, that's not going to work on me.
Oh, I don't
know. Biatch. No, I'm going to be like, I know what you're doing. I'm like, That's an eye gaze, and I'm not looking into your eyes, and you can't get me.
Imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees. High above you, the air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like, is offered purely as commentary. Because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, you are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A Little Bit Culty loves you.
Well, that was fascinating. We actually have a great Nityananda word salad, but we're going to save it for the end of episode 2.
You're going to have to hold on.
Yeah, just hold on. It's going to be good. It'll be worth it. See you then.
Bye.
Bye. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean. I'm hanging on to the weight of my love. If I let go of it all, I could leave. But I know.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. Takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.